Welcome to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And I'm Steve Hayward.
This week on Off Topic, we talk about sharing, copyright, and the creative process.
We talked to filmmaker and photographer Clay Haskell about a photograph of his that goes everywhere.
When I got to Google Image Search and found, just all these different examples of my image, I went back and found that CBS News had basically been the one who'd found it first.
We talked to author Cory Doctorow about the internet, his creative process, and copyright law.
It's like saying that there was a law that prohibited my grandparents from carving their names on the moon with a green laser.
Idris Goodwin fills us in about the extent to which hip-hop culture depends on the kindness of strangers.
What's the one thing you can't download? You can't download the live performance.
And we talked to Professor Marcus Boone about his book, In Praise of Copying.
There's something of a myth that intellectual property is simply protecting the producer.
This is Off Topic. Stay with us.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And I'm Steve Hayward.
Steve, you're an author. You make money off of book sales, having the copyright on these things. How do you feel about people downloading your work on the internet?
You know, I don't know how I feel about it. Like, I mean, on the one hand, I feel like I feel like it's mine. I feel like if somebody's going to buy my book, that's what they should be doing with my book. You know, that's what being an author is all about. On the other hand, the idea that there are legions of people across the globe
desperate
and illegally downloading the Hayward because they need to have Don't Be Afraid or some kind of – which is, by the way, available at the bookstore. but the idea that there are people who are risking their life and limb
or at least a little jail time.
But really, like, what is the difference? I mean, you know, what is there a difference between going in – to a record store, going into an HMV and taking a CD and like running like anything out the exit and downloading an album?
Well, and there's another thing. You know, I actually have a couple of Steve Hayward books at my house that I bought used. I bought them used. So, you know, you didn't get any money for that, but you got a fan in me. Isn't that sort of nice?
I think this is the riddle of artistic production. Is it better to get paid or is it better to get read? And that's what we're talking about today. Professor Stillman didn't know how he had ended up with the worst office in the college, only that he had. It was the only place on campus where you couldn't get a Wi-Fi or cell phone signal. The lead-lined, windowless walls of his office had been built in the late 60s and were designed to be impervious to radiation. In the event of a nuclear attack, Stillman had been informed, the rest of the English department was to take shelter in his office. The director of campus safety had dropped by to tell him this in person. "The entire English department," said Stillman. "You have a problem with that?" From the way the other man said it, Stillman knew he had no choice. Professor Stillman had never liked sharing. He knew this for a fact. His own mother had sent him some of his old school report cards, and Stillman noted he'd got very low marks in first grade in a category called Shares Well with Others. Out of a possible 4 points, he'd got 1. He'd got the equivalent of a D- in sharing well with others. "How can you grade someone on that?" Stillman had asked. "Believe me," his mother replied, "that 1 out of 4 was generous. I was a very good reader," said Stillman. "I got a 4 in reading." "I thought you were going to end up a doctor," said his mother. "I mean a real doctor, not a professor of literature." At the college, Stillman held office hours every Wednesday, and each week it was mostly the same. He'd sit alone and wait for students to come talk to him. Most other professors had lines outside their doors, but not him. Somehow his students got enough of him during class. It was perhaps because Stillman got so few visitors that he remembered the woman and the camera with such clarity. She was in her late 20s and the camera was forbiddingly large. Clearly not a student, she knocked on the door and asked to take his photo. "Have we met?" he asked her. "You're perfect," she told him, not answering his question. Stillman sat up straighter behind his desk and she snapped a photo, then another. Stillman smiled. I'm not sure we want you smiling, she told him. She snapped a few more, the frames clicking by with a speed Stillman thought improbable. He tried not to blink. Okay, she told him. How about one of you talking on the phone? Stillman picked up the phone and looked over at her. Not like that, she told him. We need you to pretend to be having a real conversation with a real person. That's what we're looking for. When you say we, said Stillman, who are you talking about? Perfect, she said, and again the frames clicked by. It was over in less than 5 minutes. Can I get copies? Stillman tried asking her, but she was already gone. Walked out of his office and around a corner, and all at once it was like she had never been there. Neither Professor Tynan in the office across the hall nor Professor Sarche had even seen her. Neither had Paula, the English department secretary. She was here to photograph you? Paula had asked, with more incredulity than he would have liked. She said I was perfect, Stillman almost said, but then he didn't. That had been several months ago, and though it had been strange at the time, Stillman eventually forgot about it. But then, just last week, while reading a newspaper online, something had caught his eye in the corner of his computer screen. It was an advertisement for erectile dysfunction. There he was, sitting behind his office desk in his gray suit, the phone pressed to his ear. It was hard for Stillman to know if he was supposed to be the sufferer or not. Maybe he was the doctor, standing by to take calls. The next day, there he was again, though this time it was an advertisement for personal injury lawyers. He was there, in his gray suit, the phone still pressed to his ear. Only this time he seemed to be saying, "Been in an accident? Talk to an experienced lawyer." Soon other people were noticing. "I saw you in an ad for cell phones," said Paula, the English department secretary, "and in another one for emergency carpet cleaning." "I saw you in a presentation some kid did in my econ class," his student Henry had informed him. "There you were, talking on the phone. The kid said he downloaded you for free." "I seriously would contemplate legal action," said Professor Tynan from his office across the hall. "That is your likeness, and as such, it is your property." Stillman knew he should do something, but didn't know what, or even if he wanted to. The fact was, he didn't mind the idea of being just anybody. An everyman, an ordinary man with ordinary problems, someone who could be counted upon to pick up the phone. On his computer screen, there popped up an ad for car insurance, and there he was again in his gray suit. He thought of that D-minus he'd got in sharing all those years ago. Maybe they were wrong. Maybe he really was exactly what they were looking for. This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jeffrey.
And this is the sharing episode. We're going to begin today, Kathy, with a story that comes to us from a photographer, filmmaker, a friend of ours named Clay Haskell.
Right.
So it begins when Clay takes a photograph, and it's quite a striking, ironic, satirical photograph. And it's part of a wider series of photographs that he took that featured pictures really of signs.
And I remember seeing the "Look Here for a New Career" billboard, on the side of a road, you know, at one point. And I remember seeing a dumpster there, and I thought to myself, you know, that's kind of interesting. And I remember pulling over and putting a long lens on my camera, and it was, you know, at that moment that the man walked in and started to look through the dumpster.
The sign says, "Look here for a new career." And under, just right underneath the sign, there's pictured a guy, you can't really see his face, diving into a dumpster.
Right.
So you can see why this is, you can see the satirical idea behind the photograph. And it's one of those moments where Clay just happened to see it, "Look here for a new career," and then it's quite a striking image.
Right.
And so he takes us around 1999, and as one does with artistic work, holds on to it.
It just wasn't something that I had, really had a chance to sort of show a lot of people until, of course, the economic crisis of 2008. And I thought to myself, well, gee, I think now this particular photo, and some of these other photos maybe, but maybe this particular photo would have some sort of resonance now in the current economic climate.
the photograph takes on a real significance.
So had this photograph been published before?
Right. It hasn't been published. What he does is he puts it online.
I put him on my website, and I put him on a Flickr page that was linked to my website, and I put a bunch of tags so that it could be found, tags like job search and, you know, things like that, figuring that I would find people who would find the photograph and maybe want to license the photograph.
What happens next is that it gets, as things will on the internet, it gets shared.
About 40 days after I posted it online, predictably, somebody did pick it up. They found it, I think, through Flickr on my copyrighted, you know, it's right there with the copyright notice and everything. It was CBS News.
It appears on CBS News.
Wow.
It appears literally thousands of times. It appears on blogs. It appears on employment websites. And in fact, he doesn't really actually know everywhere that it goes until technology catches up. And what appears then is the Google reverse image search.
Ah.
So then what he does is he puts that image into the Google reverse search engine.
Right.
And that's when he finds all of the places. Of course, he's, you know,
thousands of them.
Thousands everywhere that it goes.
When I went back and found, when I got to Google Image Search and found, you know, just all these different examples of my image, I went back and found that CBS News had basically been the one who'd found it first and blast published it everywhere. And it was their story that seemed to be copied time and time again by these people who were doing for-profit blogs, things like career search blogs or how to get an online writing career or online blogging career blogs or how to make more money in creative design blogs. And everybody was using my image in this way to say, you know, hey, you can make more money. And more, you know, just dozens and dozens and dozens of these things, all patterned on that original CBS News story. And it appeared in, you know, everywhere. I mean, just there were Russian pages and Greek pages and Korean pages and Japanese pages. Everybody used it.
And his name is not attached to this by this point.
By this point, it's shorn of any of the identifying marks that mark it as his artistic production. And Clay is watching this with great interest and also with a degree of powerlessness, wondering what he is going to do about this sharing.
This is a major corporation that spends millions of dollars every year on copyright protection and intellectual property legal, you know, protection, because it's their business model. They are a creator and distributor of intellectual property. And for them to just use my intellectual property this way without even contacting me, and for it to lead to an internet meme where, you know, hundreds of people are using my image in the very same way without contacting me, you know, it just became sort of it was a wake-up moment for me about the implications of the internet highway, if you will. I mean, I contacted them. I laid out my timeline. I laid out the blogging meme that they had created, and I waited, and they got back in touch with me. And to their great credit, they saw my side of things. They stood up, and we came to terms with it. I wasn't so lucky with the hundreds and hundreds of other people, you know, that use it online all over the world. You know, it's still out there in various places. I still contact Facebook and, you know, Blogger and various places all the time about copyright, you know, infractions on my image. And they take them down, you know. I have to, it's a constant sort of, you know, trying to put out the fire. But it's, you know, it's a learning experience for me. I think it's, I mean, I love the idea of how interconnected we are. I love the idea that when I want to search for an image of something specific, I can find it. But at the same time, what that means is that there's been a radical devaluation of intellectual property. And when that happens, you can't make money doing those things, essentially. And this is why the big corporations have put things into place like the copyright alert system. I mean, this is the six strikes thing is going into place right now. It's it protects big big corporations who have lots of intellectual property. It protects them from copyright thieves and pirates, but it doesn't protect, you know, individuals. It doesn't protect the individual, you know, copyright holder, the place where intellectual property is born, the individual, the person who creates something.
In the publishing world, of course, there are a variety of opinions about this. And we talked to author Cory Doctorow, co-editor of Boing Boing, one of the most popular and influential blogs on the web today, who is an enormously prolific, award-winning novelist.
He releases his books for free, is that right?
On the same day that the books are released for sale, he also makes them available to download for free. And he has very different ideas about creativity and copyright protection of creative works.
I mean, you would think that would have a detrimental effect on his ability to sell books.
He argues exactly the opposite. In fact, that the more that he's made more money on the books that he has simultaneously released for free download than he did on books before he was able to do that, that were released only for sale.
I actually think that's more just rational economics, rational in the sense that it doesn't rely on wishful thinking or high-minded moralizing to arrive at a conclusion about what the best economic activity should be. You can sit there and moan all day long about how bad piracy is, but but moaning is not a way to eliminate piracy, and neither is anything else that anyone has ever done been a way of eliminating or stemming the tide of piracy. We've had now a good 15, 20 years of so-called anti-piracy laws, and piracy has done nothing but go up. And the laws have had tons of externalities, bad consequences on the outside to people who aren't involved in the arts and some for people who are. But they've done nothing at all to stem the tide of copying. So, you know, while I do make all my books available as free downloads the same time as they come out in stores, everybody else's books are also available as free downloads at the same time as they come out in stores, right? The difference is that I'm performing a public act of trust and generosity that creates a social contract with some of those people who download that encourages them to do everything they can to try and make my life better. I mean, obviously, people don't copy books because they dislike artists. You know, they may be indifferent to them, but you know, nobody's ever downloaded a song or downloaded a book because they had animus for the artist. And so, if you can turn at the very least indifference into some kind of goodwill, then maybe people will find a way to do you a good turn. And so what I focus on is trying to find ways to make it easy for people to give me a good turn. I'm, as I say sometimes, I'm not interested in making sure that everybody who reads my book pays. I'm making sure that everybody who's willing to pay reads my book.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray. We've been talking with Cory Doctorow, author and internet activist. Stay with us.
I'm Steve Hayward, and this is Off Topic.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
You know, Kathy, one of the things that Cory Doctorow is saying is that it makes profound sense for an artistic producer, for an author, for a photographer, for a filmmaker to give his or her work away.
Right.
Is there a rational basis for that? I mean, to me, it doesn't make sense, but What do you think?
Well, I think one of the things that we're talking about here is what is the thing that a creative producer is going for? So in my research on the South Pacific island of Rarotonga, it's a place where is no copyright law.
Where is it, Rarotonga?
Rarotonga is in the South Pacific. It's exactly in the South Pacific where Hawaii is in the North Pacific.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it happens to be the center of an incredible explosion of artistic productivity all over the South Pacific. There are more art galleries per capita on Rarotonga than there is in London, Paris, New York, even a small town like Santa Fe, New Mexico, that's filled with art galleries. Per capita, Rarotonga has more. And it has art of all kinds, from the most traditional carvings to, you know, oil paintings to postmodern multimedia mm-hmm. installation art. All of it. It's really a place where artistic creativity is really flowering.
And it's a place where they give away their art?
The Polynesian culture, the highest value in Polynesian culture is generosity. So that the whole culture is really structured around the idea of giving, and that it has long, long roots in traditional Polynesian culture. So the one of the artists there said to me, you know, we tell children when they're growing up, there are two kinds of people. There are people who take and there are people who give. And the people who take are bad people and the people who give are good people. So it really is a culture where people work very hard and really value generosity above all other things. It doesn't matter how much money you have. If you're greedy, you're at the bottom of the social scale. If you're generous, you're at the top of it.
So it's a place where sharing is not just the default option, but there's actually some kind of advantage to sharing.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, doesn't that circle, though, around to the same place? Like, the more I share, the more I get?
Absolutely. And that's the way it works, so that people are sharing all the time. And you would think, oh, if you're giving things away all the time—your time, your possessions, your help with things—that you're constantly looking to see how you can be generous to others, how you can help others, how you can give to others. You think, don't you end up with nothing? And the answer to that is no, you end up with tons of stuff because people are doing this all the time. And it makes the whole culture supports this. And that's very different from a lot of the "I got mine, you get yours, Jack" mm-hmm. attitude that we often see in North America. And my argument in my research is that is one of the reasons why creativity and artistic production flourish there. People give each other art supplies, studio space, help hanging yeah. their works. It's, you know, framing. They're constantly giving, teaching, helping, loaning, sharing all the time. And it does create a world where artistic production is happening all the time. All the time.
You know, it sounds good, but I find it very hard to think about it in any kind of rational way, because no matter how much I say it's good to share, and mm-hmm. no matter how much I try to think that the more I share, the more I'll get, I still find myself back to the same place of thinking that, you know, my stuff is my stuff.
But Steve, you already are doing it. You already are participating in this. And this sort of takes me back to something that Corey was talking about how art is tied into larger intellectual and material sharing.
I think everybody who is involved in creativity, including studio executives, admits that there's parts of the creative process that we could call plumbing that are not creative per se and shouldn't be propertized. And then there's stuff that you might call snowflakes, which are the precious things that you make yourself that are one of a kind. And the thing that's missing in contemporary Western conceptions of creativity is the truth that all snowflakes become plumbing, right? That Edgar Allan Poe, when he beheld the first detective novel, which he invented, a genre he invented, looked at his genre and held it in his hands and said, "I have made a snowflake." But today, we call it plumbing. And both of those things are simultaneously true. He made a snowflake. It is better for society, for the world, even for Poe, because being known as the inventor of a genre that consists of one story you wrote is much less significant than having your posterity remember you as the man who invented a genre that there are whole bookstores devoted to. It is better for us, for that snowflake, to become plumbing. And the difference between snowflakes and plumbing is intimately bound up in something that especially Americans never want to talk about, which is privilege and class and sometimes race. So you get things like think of a musical composition, right? You have the rhythm and you have the melody. Rhythms are plumbing. You can't copyright a rhythm. Melodies are snowflakes. Melodies are protected. There is nothing that you could explain to you, that you could use to explain to a Martian why one is and one isn't plumbing or snowflakes. But there is something important about our history and the history of power here, which is that Afro-Caribbean music stresses complex polyrhythm. And to a certain approximation, you can have a song in the Afro-Caribbean tradition that is that has the same rhythm and a different melody, and it still is the same song. Western European music stresses melodic elements, and so you can take a melody and you can put a different rhythm behind it, and the song remains the same. It's not a new song. Now, the fact that a bunch of record executives whose musicians were ripping off black R&B artists declared the part that the black R&B artists contribute to be plumbing and the part that the white artists were laying down on top of it to be snowflakes is not an accident. Right, that didn't happen in a vacuum. If it had been the other way around, if at the dawn of popular recorded music, there had been a Senegalese record label that released a bunch of Western melodies that were in copyright, but put different African polyrhythms behind them, and released them into records that became million sellers around the world, the reaction would have been total outrage. And so, you know, there is something important going on here, right? There is something about power, and its relationship to culture. And I think that the wrong thing to take away from this is, oh, well, we can create justice by turning everyone's plumbing back into snowflakes, by saying anytime you want to use anything that came out of someone else's head, you have to get their permission and take a license. Because nothing works that way. That's not how we got African complex polyrhythm. African complex polyrhythm evolved because of free taking in the same way that Western melodic traditions did. I mean, there's a reason that Brahms's first was called Beethoven's 10th. The way that you make melodies is the same way you make rhythms, by incrementally improving on the melodies and rhythms that came before you, in the same way that the way that we invent new kinds of stories is by taking the stories that we've heard and varying them and adapting them to our circumstance and infusing them with something that is on the one hand deeply personal, but on the other hand totally enmeshed with something that came before.
Been having a conversation with author Cory Doctorow, where he's been making the point that when people are cultural producers, when they're creators, they're not up in the garret by themselves, but are drawing from the larger cultural tradition. They're drawing from work that has come mm-hmm. before.
It reminded me, listening to Doctorow talk about those things, it reminded me of the discussion that we had with Idris Goodwin. Now, Idris is a hip-hop recording artist. His most recent album is called Breakbeat Poems. He's also an essayist. His book of essays that just came out is called These Are the Breaks. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to him about hip-hop culture and about the ways in which hip-hop is dependent on the generosity, the sharing, about things being out there that one can sample and pull from and create with.
Salute. This is for the owners. This is for the sowers who never see the flowers. This is for the powers, for determination. This is for the hours. And I don't mean that movie. I'm
talking
dedication.
All right, so
dedication.
We just... Hip-hop culture, to what extent is it dependent on the generosity of others?
I think you're referring specifically to...
To samples.
To samples, yeah. So I guess in this instance, you're talking mostly about the music itself, the songs. You know, ever since Rapper's Delight, I said a hip-hop, a hit.
You don't stop, rock it out, baby, rubber to the boogity, bang, bang, the boogity to the boogity beat.
That beat is from the song Good Times, the disco record Good Times, right? And so Rapper's Delight is pretty much the first rap record. And so since then, that tradition has continued where you take a popular song or even to another degree, you take a song that's maybe not as known. And that's the whole point of that. It's like trying to get away with creating something that no one recognizes. So it's like, oh, where did you get that snare from, or where did you get that horn sample from? And the whole idea is like, you'll never know, you know what I mean?
Right.
So the game is like, okay, let's see if you can figure out what samples I used. Or there's the Puff Daddy kind of like, you know, you remember that Michael Jackson song you liked? Well, here it is again, except right. It's with me rapping on it, you know?
Now, what y'all want to do? Want to be ballers, shot callers, brawlers.
And so it takes like a fragment of the thing that you know, and then it frames it in a different context, and suddenly life is breathed into it, or it's framed in a different way, and it brings it to life in a way that you hadn't thought of it before.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, the whole idea is actually very like, very sweet, actually, because what it is it's essentially like the DJ celebrating these parts of these records, you know. And it's the DJ was like, everybody loves this part of the record particularly, specifically, so what if I found a way to just like expand on it,
right,
build on it? And I always say that one of the things that the hang-ups that I have with a lot of like newer hip-hop music or newer rap music is that people don't sample as much anymore. And I understand why they don't do that. The idea being, well, we want to make our own music. We don't want to pay for those samples. People are going to sue us. You know, I want to use instruments, whatever, whatever, which I totally get. But what you lose out on is that whole idea of music appreciation, that whole idea of fusing different cultures together, right? So one of my favorite rap instrumentals of all time is a song called When They Reminisce Over You by Pete Rock and CL Smooth. When I take back, I recall a man off the family tree, my right hand, Papa Jack. You know, the primary samples on that song are artists that you would not normally categorize together. The only reason that I know anything or care anything about any other kind of music is because of all the rap music I was listening to as a kid, and then I started recognizing those samples and other songs, and I went back to them. And so then I became like this sort of DJ, you know, this DJ mind where I was like scouring the record bins looking for stuff, even though I didn't have turntables or anything at the time, but I would try to find certain things, and it made me want to like actively go out and seek cool sounds and old music. Just as you hesitate two eyes to make a pair. A lot of these like old school classic producers, now the newer generation is like taking records that they made. So, for example, the When They Reminisce Over You that I'm talking about.
Right, yeah.
So Lupe Fiasco, who's a newer hip hop artist, took Pete Rock's beat for When They Reminisce Over You and made a new song out of it. First off, say peace to Pine Ridge, shame and all the damage that the white man wine did, ghost dance. And they changed it slightly. And then Pete Rock got upset. Because he's like, you took this beat, and this beat was very important to me. This song was about, you know, a person who was very dear to me who passed away and all that. And so it's kind of ironic that you now have, you know, the older generation, newer artists are taking their beats in an attempt to to honor them. But then they're like, well, no, you know.
Yeah, so the older generation, which has this whole aesthetic, really, that's built on theft, as you were saying, in some kind of way, where this sort of opportunistic, non-copyright and almost willfully obscure in a sense, right? Because they're unearthing the beats that we've forgotten about. They're giving us this perspective on a song or on a particular part of a song, even, and really bringing it to light in this unpredictable, unthought of way when the original was produced. They're then asserting a form of copyright then, or a form of proprietary.
Yeah, it's like because of what I did with it. Like you know, it's like, I put these ingredients together in a certain way. You know, it's a recipe. It's like, you know, what I created was the recipe. I didn't create tomatoes. I didn't create, you know, pasta. But the way I put it together, you know, is the thing that makes me an artist.
And now for my next number, I'd like to return to the classic.
You know, so just to give a little context on what I'm talking about is like there are three primary figurehead DJs in hip hop culture, right? So that are pretty much where everything else sprouts out of, right? So DJ Kool Herc is the first one to play around with extending a section of music by jumping between two turntables. So he's queuing up the same section and it plays on one, and then he switches to the other and it plays on the other, and then he cues it up on the other one, and then he switches to the other one, right? Then you get Afrika Bambaataa, and Afrika Bambaataa's whole thing was about what we're talking, like obscure selection, juxtaposing seemingly unrelated music together. So he'll take Kraftwerk, and then he'll take like the drum break from like the Mickey Mouse Club, and then he'll take some from the Monkees, and then he'll take like a Glenn Miller, you know, whatever. It's like all about just playing stuff that people would be like, "What? Whoa!"
So the first one is about cool, a kind of interruption. The second one, a kind of juxtaposition.
Yes, and then Grandmaster Flash comes in. What he does is he brings in the technological advancements. He invents the crossfader. He makes it possible for you to, for all these things to be refined and come off more seamless.
It seems that when you learn to play, say, a Robert Johnson riff mm-hmm. on the guitar, you learn how to play the riff. You reproduce the riff in some kind of tempo, or you actually have to play it again mm-hmm. on the guitar. With DJs, they don't learn the riff. They really copy it in some kind of way. Is that a legitimate distinction?
Yeah, I guess in a way copying, but not in the same way that it's just like, okay, I'm just going to take this one part and I'm just going to play this one part over and over and over and over again. I think it's more about like, you know, I have a vision in my mind. Now let me see what from this bin of objects can I create this thing out of. So it's like the same thing a collagist or someone who does you know, mixed media work or whatever, the hip hop sonic artist has the idea first. Like, okay, you know, I'm working with an artist like Jay-Z. And so an artist like Jay-Z has a certain quality to him. He has a certain aesthetic. So I'm going to try to find a certain kind of bass line. I'm going to try to find certain kind of drums. I'm going to try to find a certain kind of vocal samples, you know? And so it's not like, you know, I think what Puff Daddy was doing was, I think, more akin to just, I'm just going to play the same Robert Johnson riff again
over it,
and just
yeah.
put me over it because people like it. Because he would just literally, I mean, just flat out just kind of take a thing mm-hmm. and just be like, here's that thing.
Check it out. Seems like yesterday we used to rock the show. I laced the track, you locked the flow.
It was more about the recognition of that. And oh my God, now Lil' Kim's rapping on it, you know, which yeah. is fine. It has its place, and sometimes that simplicity is kind of a cool thing. But I think in terms of what we're thinking about, you know, artists like Pete Rock or DJ Premier, these really like respected, iconic people who sort of mastered the art. You know, Kanye West in his earlier career, I mean, now I think he's getting further away from samples. But, you know, it was much more about just using existing sounds to convey a certain kind of sound, kind of mood, kind of texture.
I'm speaking to Idris Goodwin. His most recent album is Breakbeat Poems. Stay with us.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Giffray.
And I'm Steve Hayward. How do we reimagine a society that is built on sharing? How do we reimagine a society where copying is something to be praised rather than condemned? The person who we posed that question to is Marcus Boone, who's the author of a very suggestive, a very, I think, provocative and challenging book called In Praise of Copying.
Well, the word socialism comes to mind. Unpopular as that word is today, but, you know, if there was actual support for cultural producers from the government, from the state, from the nation, then the need to profit individually by selling copies on the market would be less drastic. But I think it's an open question how that would happen. I think it's a broader question for our society right now in general. You know, how are people going to get paid for work? And, you know, mostly when you talk to musicians and people involved in the music industry, it's not like individual musicians are making huge amounts of money off of their recordings and the way, you know, the way in which those recordings are protected by intellectual property law. Often money is made by corporations, by big businesses. People do work for hire, in which case they don't get any royalties.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the conditions under which people make art, especially historically when you look at it, like people haven't made much money off of royalties, and there's something of a myth that intellectual property law is simply protecting the producer. I mean, it's protecting the producer in the sense of the entrepreneur who pays for the making of the copies and the distributing of them, whether that's the film production company or the book publisher or the company that puts out CDs.
I want to ask you about your own book, In Praise of Copying, which you can download for free from the Harvard University Press website. Can you tell me a little bit about? Can you talk a little bit about that decision to allow for those downloads, and if that what was Harvard's reaction?
I think they were actually surprisingly supportive of it. Like, to me, it just seemed after I'd written a book called In Praise of Copying that to not allow people to make copies of it fairly freely was somewhat disingenuous. And so I just suggested, you know, could we make PDFs available online? And basically, Harvard said yes. I mean, I think the book industry right now is in turmoil. Nobody really understands how they're going to make money in the future and what the relationship between digital copies of books and hard copies of books actually is. And so I think they saw it as a kind of experiment, you know, just to see whether the availability of a free PDF of the book would actually harm sales or whether it would support sales in some way.
And did it? What happened?
I think the book has done pretty well, actually. I mean, it's sold a few thousand copies in hardback. And, I mean, most of the people I talk to seem to have read the PDF of the book. So from my point of view, my goal was to spread my thoughts to as many people as possible, and the PDF is great for that. I mean, personally, I still like to read hard copies of books as well. So it's possible that those two distribution systems, the digital and the, you know, the old print industry, like maybe they do support each other to some degree. I don't know. I think it's an open question. And of course now, I mean, even in the last couple of years, Kindle and electronic book publishing has expanded. And I mean, that's an experiment too, to see to what degree that replaces traditional publishing and what the relationship between, say, Kindle and free PDF is.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Marcus, for being with us. My guest today has been Marcus Boone. You can go on to the Harvard University Press website and download his The Praise of Copying for free, or you can buy a copy at a bookstore near you. Thanks, Marcus, for being with us.
Thanks, Steve. Cheers.
This is Off Topic, and I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And it seems to me that the protection of copyright is at least as much about the protection of corporations as it is about the protection of artistic producers.
And this is one of the things we talked about with Cory Doctorow, is this really about what we think it is, protecting artists, or is it about protecting money for the big suits?
You know, copyright historically has had this weird dual nature. So on the one hand, we've said, oh, copyright binds everybody in the world who makes or handles copies of works. But until very recently, everybody who made or handled a copy of a work was doing something industrial. Every copy of a book had a printing press in its history. Every copy of a record had a record factory. Every film had a film lab. And so saying, oh, copyright binds the man with the printing press just as much as it does the little girl next door, was kind of a fig leaf, because in actual fact, the little girl next door was incapable of making a copy of a book. It's like saying that there was a law that prohibited my grandparents from carving their names on the moon with a green laser. I mean, the fact that they never fell afoul of that law doesn't mean that it's a law that is good for wide applicability. It may just be that carving the moon, your name on the moon with a green laser, is extraordinarily difficult. And if it became incredibly easy, we might need to reconsider our rules about it. And so what's happened is the internet made it really easy to make and handle copies. It didn't make everybody a member of the entertainment industry, though. And because the rules for copyright had always been made just by taking whatever it was the entertainment industry routinely did and just enshrining them into law, it suddenly made everybody in the world, that is, everybody who uses the internet, liable to following this set of rules that had been written to be interpreted by extremely high-powered, high-paid, and very specialized entertainment industry attorneys. And nobody is capable of doing that. You know, there is no set of rules that's, on the one hand, robust enough to allow Universal to license Harry Potter from Warner to build the Universal Harry Potter theme park, and on the other hand, simple enough to let a little girl in her mother's basement in Orlando down the street to make a Harry Potter fan website without falling afoul of the law. It's either fit for one purpose or the other, and what we've done is we've kept it fit for the entertainment industry's purpose, which means that nobody can hope to follow it in their daily round. And I think that it's possible to be pro-copyright in the sense of saying, well, we should have rules that govern the entertainment industry, and maybe we even need rules about what people who aren't in the entertainment industry do with so-called content, with creative works. But the idea that they should be the same set of rules is bizarre. It's like saying, well, I believe in banking rules, and I believe that if you borrow $5 from your friend for lunch, you should pay him back. And therefore, everybody should just follow the same rules that the SEC lays out for Fortune 100 companies. It's just wrong.
This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
You know, Kathy, let's go back for a moment to Idris Goodwin. Mm-hmm. He's a scholar of hip-hop. He's a playwright. He's an essayist. He's a hip-hop recording artist. And as such, he has a very interesting, very striking perspective on the question of his getting paid for his art and his survival as an artist. For him, it's all about sharing. Correct me if I have this wrong. One of your songs goes, I ain't doing this for myself. I ain't doing this to amass great wealth. But there is one thing I would like to mention. The tax men don't accept good intentions. Is that it?
Something like that. Yeah, more or less.
I think it really articulates, or really, really raises one of the things that we've been talking about, is the question of what happens to the cultural producer. How do you get paid today by making art?
Honestly, man, for me, it's not something that I've ever really concerned myself with as far as, being ripped off or somebody taking something or how will I protect my art or any of this kind of stuff. I always look at it as like if I ever have that problem, that's a good problem to have, you know. I went to Nairobi, which is in Kenya, and I went on this theater delegation, And we went to this public sort of play mm-hmm. thing. And the woman who took us to that was telling us that often the theater artists and storytellers will go around in different communities and they'll perform. And it's not rare for someone to get up from the audience to stop the person and say, oh, that's not how you tell it. This is how you tell it. And they'll take the story over. And the guy who originally started doing it has to, like, fight to get the story back. And you know, mm-hmm. and that person who interrupted him, they might be from two towns over, and they tell the story a certain way, you know. And so it's very much about, you know, this issue with sampling, in my mind, really just comes down to our very entitled culture of ownership and sort of as we're seeing the record industry sort of shift and have to adapt and change to technology, I think we're going to see less and less of it.
Less and less emphasis on ownership, less on property.
Maybe so.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, honestly, because I think artists are – we're always going to adapt. Like, we're going to find a way to get around it or protect ourselves or not protect ourselves. I don't think it's anything to worry about, really. I mean, you know, like I said, I think if somebody makes $1 billion and I'm on their song going like, hey, everybody, you know, yeah. I want a piece of that jagillion, you know,
yeah.
shave me off like a quarter jagillion. But if that's not what we're talking about, like, who cares? Like, I got other stuff. I got other songs. And I mean, is that really my job to be like policing? You know, it was like the whole thing when the whole Napster thing yeah. was starting off. I remember this episode of Charlie Rose with Lars Ulrich, the drummer yeah. from Metallica,
yeah.
and Chuck D from Public Enemy, and they had very opposing opinions on it.
Metallica being all about copyright, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were like, yeah, well, of course. I mean, these are like the stadium guys. Like, yeah. you know, they want that ownership. And Chuck D, he said something I'll never forget. He was just like, look, he's like, I'm all about my audience and the people. And so if the people are doing something, I'm going to try to adapt to that. You know, if yeah. people want to get music by sharing it, whatever, I need to adapt to what the people are doing. I can't be one guy just being like, hey, everyone, stop doing that. You know what I'm saying?
Though it is kind of interesting just to put that example alongside your Kenyan example, where that, you know, where it really is a tradition. It seems to me like a very much a folk tradition, right? Where these people who have access to these stories, it's not through any kind of mediation.
Yeah.
But the kind of issues that Metallica and Chuck D were debating, it's all about mediation. And I guess the question is, so then do all these people torrenting down the latest Idris Goodwin CD, are they the Volk? Are they the folk now? Are they the
sure.
– do they occupy to you the same space as in that Kenyan example?
I would say so, just in terms of just like – you know, look, it's not – it takes a few minutes to – go get something, to actively seek out something
yeah.
to say, I am going to download this now, you know, and to wait and to open it up and to, you know, put it in your iTunes and put it in your iPod or whatever. I mean, it just takes a few minutes. It's instant. But in the sea, in the ocean, the outdoor market that is, you know, digital music right now and digital art, I mean, we have a content surplus right now. I mean, you know, trying to be an artist right now, the challenge is like, how do you stand out in that rainforest of people? So if there are people who are downloading my music, my goal is for people to listen to my music. And so if they're going to download my music, that doesn't necessarily mean those people were going to buy my music. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Like, I remember Lupe Fiasco was like complaining in this interview about, like, he's like, man, like 90,000 people downloaded, you know, such and such album before it came out. You know, that's 90,000 albums that I didn't sell. And I'm like, why are you assuming they would have bought it? Right? Like, why do you, you know, sometimes it's like somebody's willing to buy it.
Doesn't the fact that they download it mean that they're never going to buy it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, but that, not necessarily.
Lupe Fiasco's not completely out to lunch when he says.
But that doesn't mean that they guarantee. That means, like, for me, example, like, there are things that I will absolutely download and listen to, and then there are things that I will buy. You know what I'm saying? Like, to purchase some, to actually give someone your $15 or whatever, is very different than someone saying, "I'll give this a listen."
Uh-huh.
And I do think, yeah, did he probably lose some sales? Absolutely. But I just think that's just what it means to be a professional artist right now. You have to take that into account. And I just think it's this very sort of, it's perception. It's like, for me, I do not have, just because I can make some stuff.
Yeah.
That does not mean that I'm entitled to tons of people going out and purchasing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And for me, it's always about at the end of the day, you can't fake. What's the one thing you can't download? You can't download the live performance, right?
Right.
And so for me, that's what it comes down to is you know, me in a room performing for people, you know. And that's one of the things I love about playwriting is that you can't, you know, it's like you can't download a play, and why the hell would you? So I think it's a lot of it is just about perception. And I think it just depends on your personal view of what you're entitled to as an artist. But also it's like, look, this is just a fact. I mean, it's just the technology exists so that people, you know, can do this. And you just, we just have to, if you're deciding you want to be in this business, the one thing you have to figure out is like, okay, how do I give something people they don't have? Or how do I, you know, that's the challenge that's always been there. And I think to sort of like kind of whine and complain about you know, possible loss of revenue is just kind of like, well, you know, just adapt. You just got, that's just how it is, man. It's just like, as Chuck D said, that's what the people are doing. So you need to figure out, A, if this is something you still want to do, or B, how do you work within that?
Idris Goodwin, fascinating perspective, fascinating discussion. I'm Steve Hayward. You're listening to The Off Topic. Thanks for being here.
I ain't doing this for my health. I ain't doing this to amass great wealth. However, I would like to mention, you can't pay rent with no good intentions. I ain't doing this for love. My mama loved me. Nor am I trying to be the next.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And we're talking this week about sharing and about creativity and about how those two things may fit together.
I think that a lot of us think that creativity doesn't come from sharing, right? When we first begin to write, when we first begin to produce any kind of art, we have this really romantic idea of really coming from nowhere. Of the, I'm gonna create something. The idea of creation, do something that somebody else has done,
right,
and or has never done.
And it's interesting that you use the idea romantic there, because this is a conception of creativity that didn't exist until the Romantic era, until the 1800s, when we really have that idea that the gods are going to reach down with a thunderbolt and strike you, and you're going to creatively produce. So things like the Renaissance were not created in that way. It was a very workmanlike, people working in workshops, having apprentices. It was hard physical labor that created things like the Sistine ceiling.
Right, right. And the ways in which the aesthetics of copying, the idea of the copy, the idea of producing work in the manner of a master, right, in the manner of an original, that was really that idea that originality was something to be avoided. You know, when you think about artistic production in connection with copying and sharing, remixing, it doesn't seem to me that crazy of an idea that it would in some way this – that artistic production, which I – you know, so many of us associate with what is most unique about ourselves. We produce something is that is unique because we ourselves are unique. That's why we want to produce originals, because we are an original. But that whole idea, the idea of the original, the idealization of the original, maybe that's the crazy thing.
Maybe it's not so much that we should be idealizing this originality as remembering that we are part of communities that provide support, communities that provide traditions upon which we draw, and that recognizing the sources of some of our creativity are perhaps more complex than just sitting alone by ourselves and waiting for lightning to strike.
Mm-hmm. And then maybe the sources, the source of our creativity, of what is ours artistically, begins with giving it away.
Off Topic is a collaboration of KRCC and the Colorado College, produced at the Tim Gill Center for Public Media in Colorado Springs, Colorado, by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell.
To hear any part of this episode that you might have missed, or to hear previous episodes, you can find us at offtopicradio.org. Till next week, I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And stay off topic.